This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in your podcast app.
Our next speaker and our final speaker for this session is Karen Kramer from the University of Utah. And Dr. Kramer has she's a professor of anthropology there, and she's extensively examined the behavioral economics of a number of gatherer-hunter societies in South America and the Yucatec Maya. But we asked her here today to discuss a particular thread of her research that relates to stories and myths that cultural and social and physical anthropologists tell about man the hunter. So let's welcome Dr. Kramer.
All right. Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be here and be part of this CARTA symposium on the role of myth in anthropogeny. The myth that I'm going to talk about is going to put a spotlight on ourselves, and I'm going to be talking about hunting. Is it the center of the origins of human behavior? And this is a myth that's been perpetuated by ourselves as anthropologists and social scientists, and by those who consume the anthropological literature. So in talking about that, I also will be hopefully demystifying the hunting hypothesis and then shedding a light on women and children in the human evolutionary story. So the hunting hypothesis proposes that the dietary shift to meat was the catalyst that favored a suite of transformative biological and behavioral adaptations. Hunting and meat eating as prime movers in human evolution was championed by Raymond Dart in the 1950s and then furthered and popularized by many others since then. The hunting hypothesis has had broad appeal to explain the emergence of a number of seminal human behaviors, such as food sharing, the division of labor, the age division of labor, the sexual division of labor, pair bonding, cooperative breeding, male parental care, and the fact that we live in home bases. And is well captured by this quote, "Our intellect, interests, emotions, and basic social life are all evolutionary products of the hunting adaptation." So thus, the historic weight that has been given to hunting as a prime mover is foundational to how we've put together much of the evolutionary story of human sociality. Consequently, it also gives primacy or agency to men in shaping that evolutionary story. So there's no question that this complex of traits, with cooperation at its center, emerged in the human line and sends us down a very different evolutionary path than our closest non-human primate relatives. But the question that I want to ask is, was hunting the selection force? So women and children have largely been left out of theoretic models and empirical evaluations about the development of this suite of behavioral traits. So to balance this discussion, we'll revisit several interlocking misconceptions that are linked to the hunting hypothesis. So first, it's important to point out that advocates of the hunting hypothesis have spearheaded very important questions about human origins. However, the evidence that hunting and meat eating were an important part of the early human adaptation is often ambiguous, misleading, and is extensively debated. So just briefly, I'm going to look at a few examples. First, there are preservation biases, and these strongly shape our ideas about the primacy of hunting. And what I mean by that is that bones and stones preserve in the archaeological record. However, plant foods, and oftentimes the the tools that we use to extract plants, which are made of wood or antler or fiber, do not preserve in the archaeological record. So this preservation bias has really focused our attention on carnivory. Recent research is now advancing our ability to detect plant foods with the same scientific rigor that has been applied to bones and stones. We can now get some clues about plant eating in the past. Particularly promising is research on fossil dental calculus. And this is pointing to the prevalence of plant foods not only in Australopithecine diets, but also in Neanderthal diets. And second, it is very difficult to determine what stone tools were actually used for. The earliest evidence we have for stone tools is somewhere around 2.6 million years ago, and they are often simply just assumed to have been related to carnivory. Yet they could have been used in any number of other ways other than to dispatch and butcher large animals. And here are just a few examples that we have of contemporary hunters and gatherers using spear-tipped sticks to extract various other kinds of resources. Other debates have surrounded how do we interpret early cave deposits. One classic analysis by C.K. Brain determined that bone beds that were once ascribed to early hunters, Australopithecine hunters, actually turned out to be the remains of jaguars, not of human meals. So in sum, in terms of this misconception, most archaeologists would agree that the empirical paleontological evidence for hunting is ambiguous. Nonetheless, we continue to lean into hunting to explain the origin of many human behaviors. Meat certainly becomes a part of the human diet at some point. When that is largely conjecture. So a related misconception is that meat is the great dietary revolution. And what I want to point out here is that beside meat, the human diet differs markedly from that of our closest non-human primate relatives in two other very significant ways. First, compared to non-human primates, we eat very diverse diets. Studies among hunters and gatherers show that they regularly consume dozens of different animal species. For the Pume, who are the hunters and gatherers that I work with in South America, we've documented over 135 different species that they consume, and only 12% of those are game species. Most of the others are plant species and some fish and insect species as well. So we can think of meat eating as being a further dietary expansion of an otherwise diversifying diet. All right, so, and it is largely women and children women and children add a great deal to this diversity, and they are often also the ones who supply the bottom line day-to-day calories, the carbohydrates, the roots, the tubers, the cereals, the grains, the nuts, the berries, the fruit. In most environments, large game is just too unpredictable to feed everybody every day, all year long. We also process our food. Other than fruits and some leafy greens, which most hunters and gatherers aren't terribly fond of eating, most foods are not eaten raw, but require oftentimes multi-step and extensive processing. And by that I mean pounding, mashing, peeling, grinding, leaching, and cooking our food. With our relatively small guts, I can't emphasize enough how important food processing is, not only to increase the caloric bioavailability, but also to render food simply digestible. Many of the foods we eat, we simply could not eat unless they were processed. So to my thinking, this is the great revolution, is food processing, and it is women and children who largely do this work. Here's just a few examples of some of the studies we have in non-traditional economies. Women consistently spend about 25% of daylight hours, that's equivalent to about 3 hours a day, processing food. So this is being shown for the FA, a group of African hunters and gatherers, Maya women from Central America, and Pume hunters and gatherers. So in terms of this misconception, the focus on hunting has ignored the many ways that women and children contribute to dietary diversity and to food processing, which are attributes that equally set the human diet apart from other primates. So the third myth-building misconception is that hunting favored men to band together, which is best served by patrilocality. And that means that when men mate or marry, they are the ones that stay put. They stay living with their fathers and brothers, and it is women who leave to join the community of their spouse. So it's women who relocate, men who stay put. And so the traditional expectation has been that patrilocality and male philopatry, meaning that men stay where they are, women leave, is the human norm. However, when we look under the hood at the ethnographic record, what we note is that women, that humans in particular do not have a universal pattern. These are just some of the examples that are widely cited in the ethnographic literature. And so where couples live after marriage varies cross-culturally. It also varies within any one society, and it also varies across the life course. If we take a closer look at hunters and gatherers, the most common residence pattern we find is called bilocality or multilocality, meaning that within a group, sometimes the men will migrate, sometimes the females will migrate or disperse, sometimes neither will, both will stay in their natal community, and sometimes both will emigrate. And this will change several times across the course of a marriage. So when you are newly mated or married and have young children, you might decide to reside with one group of kin, and when you are more mature and have older children, you might decide to reside with another group of kin. So really the most apt characterization is that living arrangements are variable, flexible, and accommodate women and children as much as they do men's hunting needs. So in sum, in terms of this misconception, revisiting myths about the predominance of male-centric residence patterns should be considered on two counts. And one is the questionable empirical validity of characterizing hunters and gatherers and consequently often our ancestors as patrilocal. And the other is because of the impact on our last misconception. And that is that hunting favored sex differences in the cooperative nature of men versus women. The traditional expectation here is that hunting and warfare favored sex differences in the need to form alliances and to cooperate. The corollary to that is that women's cooperative nature is limited. While most evolutionary treatments of cooperation have focused on hunted foods, I think it's worth pointing out that human life history itself sets females up to be the original cooperative sex. And by that I mean that we have, humans have short periods of breastfeeding. We wean our children between 2 and 3 years. very regularly cross-culturally. That means we have short birth intervals on the order of about half that of other non-human great apes. And that consequently means is we have a very rapid reproductive pace. This is, of course, in non-contracepting societies. We can organize our fertility in a very different way. And then because weanlings are not completely on their own, we do help to support juveniles. It means that human mothers are in this very unusual life history situation for any animal, in that they have multiple dependents of different ages to care for at the same time. So this, in a nutshell, is both the life history problem, but also the solution. Mothers need help. This is a Maya mother with nine of her children. However, all those children are also the very engine that supports a life history of rapid reproduction. Lots of children means lots of helpers, and it might be fair to suggest that it was women and children who banded together to support this kind of life history. This kind of family system, where groups of mothers and children cooperate, distinguishes us among the other great apes with what I would propose to be equal weight to that of hunting. Besides cooperating to support children, women cooperate in numerous other ways. A closer look, or really any look, at the ethnographic record reveals that hunting and gathering women often forage in groups. Here's just a few examples. And that it is men who tend to forage alone. I don't mean to busy you with this table, but to make the point that while the ethnographic record has been extensively mined to support male cooperation through hunting, it has equally rich references to female cooperation across many different domains. I'm sorry, that's not very legible, but we've looked at childcare and foraging, food processing. One thing that women do in traditional societies very frequently is that a group of women and girls, children, will leave and go foraging. Others will stay back in camp and take care of children, and then they'll switch up those roles at other points. But they also cooperate in many other kinds of ways, in terms of exchange networks, general labor in ritual and ceremonial collaboration. Women do form sodalities and congresses, and they even will engage in coalitionary support at times. In terms of this misconception, most empirical research on the evolution of cooperation has centered on hunting and on men's behaviors, and yet the cooperative nature of women and girls and children more generally is evident in child rearing, foraging, food production. In non-forager societies, we see it in market organizations, sodalities, ceremonial institutions, and coalition forming. So in conclusion, to go back to the starting point, the primacy of hunting in male behaviors is traditionally linked to much of what makes us socially human. While there's no question that this suite of traits develops along the human evolutionary path, the question that I posed here is hunting this myth that is is it necessarily at the center of what makes us human? And my research has suggested that there are many other behaviors. There's many other ways that we might explain these behavioral adaptations, and particularly by the cooperative nature of men and children. So I think there's every reason to explore, to look beyond the hunting hypothesis for explanations for many of the traits that are unusual or unique to humans. So thank you foremost to the PUME and to the Maya, who I've worked with for many years, and to the granting organizations that have supported me, and thank you for your time.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.